floor. So please give him a very warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Many years ago, I found myself at a conference in Ankara, and I was seated at lunch next to a guy we got speaking. I had a fairly long conversation for about 40, 50 minutes, and then there was a hiatus, and he said to me, "You know, we have actually met before." I said, "Oh, really? And what conference was that?" Academics always spend their life going to conferences. And he said, "It wasn't a conference. I was actually at LSE. I said, "Oh, what a very small world. And which department were you in?" He said, "Actually, I was in your department." "Really? Did you do my course?" "No." "So how did we meet?" "You were my tutor for 3 years," he said. So how many people in this room have I actually taught? Have I taught anyone? To spare me the embarrassment of such, I haven't. Good. So I needn't worry about being ambushed later. Yes, I want to talk about cross-cultural dialogue because this is a project that I've been, since we mentioned Chatham House rules, that I've been associated with at the Royal Institute for International Affairs at Chatham House. We've had a number of conferences across the world. We had a conference at Georgetown University a couple of months ago, most recently at the Lee Kuan Yew School in Singapore, where I delivered a paper. I'm not going to deliver the paper that I delivered in Singapore. I'm just going to talk more about why the West has difficulty entering into dialogue with the non-Western world, and it is from a Western perspective, I hasten to add. So in the question and answer session, it might be interesting to get some Chinese perspectives as well. We might just treat that as a dialogue, not just a question and answer session. Where do we start from? Well, we start from the fact that, as you know, relations with the West, between China and the West, they're not excellent at the moment, certainly not with the United States. I now go to seminars talking about the prospects of future war between the US and China. That we didn't have seminars like that a couple of years ago. We're beginning to. People are now writing books on the subject. And it's not just, of course, the dialogue between China and the United States. It's a larger problem, which involves the Middle East, as you're probably aware from the news today and yesterday. You can see there's a lot of room to make up in the dialogue between the West and the Arab world. There's a lot of resentment, a lot of frustration, a lot of anger that has yet to be fully expressed. Now, the relations are not that bad in the sense that we're not talking about détente between the West and the Soviet Union. You may remember the key words here, coexistence. The West and China do not coexist. They actually share a great deal in common. They trade extensively. They are mixed up with each other's future, whether they like it or not, in a way that was not the case between the West and the Soviet Union. Secondly, the United States is not attempting to contain the rise of China, as it spent 50 years containing what it saw to be the growing power of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union wasn't, in fact, growing in power. It was weakening. And it was in terminal decline for the last 20 years of its existence, but we didn't know that at the time. A lot of Russians didn't know that at the time. One person who didn't know that for sure was Mikhail Gorbachev. And we're not talking, in essence, about deterrence. This is not a term that is used in the military circles that I find myself involved in. But we are talking about a dialogue of the deaf in the sense that countries are talking past each other. And the recent criticism of Hillary Clinton is a case in point. She most famously said, when you're dealing with the rise of a power, and she, of course, she didn't mention the decline of another power, but when you're dealing with two great powers who are obviously competing for influence in an area, we know how it always ends. And if, to quote her, we want it to end differently this time, we have to come up with a different story. We're talking about the possibility of strategic accommodation, not partnership. No one, I think, really thinks there can be a strategic partnership between the United States and China at the moment, but we are talking about a strategic accommodation between those two countries, something that was never reached with the Soviet Union and the West. So why am I saying that this is a problem if it's less problematic than it might appear? I think it is a problem because if you're going to enter into a strategic accommodation, you have to enter into a cultural dialogue. And there are three reasons, really, why the West has to do this. The first is the end of the American unipolar moment, which was very brief. It lasted in basically the Clinton administration years in the 1990s. The unipolar moment came to an end, I would argue, in Iraq in 2004, 2005, when the insurgency was at its height. The US simply doesn't have the money now to manage the international system as it did. Remember, the American model has always been supply side. One might call it supply side imperialism. I call it imperialism because many Americans call it imperialism. There is an American empire. I don't think one needs to be pejorative in that sense, but it was supply side. In other words, it was providing a service that much of the rest of the world wanted. For example, the Kuwait War in 1991. Always remember that if the United States had said, I'm sorry, we're not going to go to war with Saddam Hussein to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait, there wouldn't have been any military action against Iraq, and of course Iraq would still be occupying Kuwait. That's what I mean by supplying a service. Problem is, of course, in 2003, when the United States returned and invaded Iraq, it was supplying a service that the rest of the world didn't want. And that's how you delegitimize your position when you go out of supply-side imperialism into demand-side imperialism. You're creating a demand that doesn't actually exist. That was the great crisis of the legitimacy of American power. Just to remind ourselves that since 9/11, and we had the anniversary of 9/11 last week, the United States has spent $3.7 trillion fighting this war on terror. And if you want that to get that into perspective, at today's purchasing power of the dollar, the US spent $3.6 trillion on World War II. And for $3.6 trillion, which was a lot of money, it got regime change in Germany and Japan, and it got two very successful democracies and two extremely important allies who remain to this day firmly with the United States in two different alliance systems. So that's not bad for $3.6 trillion. What has the US got for $3.7 trillion? It's got an unwinnable war in Afghanistan. It's leaving in 2014. It's got a fragile, broken state in Iraq, which actually is engaged in sanctions busting against Iran. It's not even an ally. And it faces the very real prospect of becoming a satellite state of Iran in the near future. So that's the first point. That's the reality, the first reality, why the US needs dialogue now, because it's the only show in town. And of course, the country that will be dialoguing with most is China, but it will be dialoguing also with India, an extremely important partner for the future. And it will be dialoguing with Brazil now that the Monroe Doctrine's over. This is another great accomplishment of George W. Bush, that he managed to not notice that the Monroe Doctrine had gone on his watch. That period of American history is over. The relationship with Latin America will never be the same. And there will be other countries in the Middle East that the United States will be dialoguing with, Egypt being the prominent one, probably. Second thing I'd say is that we have a very fragile international order. Now, the interesting thing about China is that it is not challenging that international order. What it wants is a greater voice in the management of that international order, and that greater voice translates into votes, voting rights in organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. If China was challenging that international order, you would realize that dialogue would not be on the table. We would see the attempted containment of Chinese power. It's not a revolutionary radical state as the Soviet Union was, which is why the United States says it can live with the rise of China, even to the point of being the number one economic power. It'll take a little longer to become, if it ever does become, the number one political power, but we're talking, of course, obviously about economic competition at the moment. But the consensus is very fragile, the consensus on partnership. There's no consensus on how you punish transgressing states like North Korea, which decides to sink a South Korean ship with its crew. How do you punish North Korea? There's no agreement on that. There's no real agreement on the legitimate use of violence to deter a country from, like Iran, from acquiring nuclear weapons. Neither China nor the United States want Iran to become a nuclear power, but they cannot agree on how to stop it. There's something in our business called the risk trap. The risk trap is doing too much and doing too little. It can be equally fatal for your health. And at the moment, the international system is paralyzed when it comes to Iran because it doesn't know what it should do. It doesn't know whether it should do too much or do too little. And the third factor is, obviously, countries like China and Russia are no longer willing to offer the United States a blank check, as they did the invasion of Iraq, effectively, in 2003, or the war in Libya 2 years ago. And that was a blank check. No more blank checks are going to be issued. That's why the UN Security Council has not managed to agree to find a resolution about intervention in Syria. So we have a fragile international system, a rising country and a country that is in relative decline vis-a-vis other countries in terms of its absolute power. And therefore, we have a need for dialogue. What makes it difficult? Well, let me just identify a number of points. The first is the very idea of the West. What is the West? Academics like myself use terms such as social imaginary to describe societies. Every country has a social imaginary, a narrative, a history, a sense of identity. What's its purpose? Not every country has a purpose, by the way. My country doesn't really have a purpose in history. The United States certainly thinks it has a purpose. It's there for a reason. It's been put there by God for a reason. American exceptionalism is the narrative. It's deeply felt. When Madeleine Albright talked about the United States being the indispensable country that saw further than everyone else, that's taken as a given. She came recently to the LSE. I actually asked her, do you still think the United States is the indispensable country? And she said yes. And we are the indispensable country because we're the only global major power. And that's true. The United States is the only major global power. It thinks globally. It has a policy in every part of the world. It has interests in every part of the world. It's not a regional power. It's a global one. Now, the only other community that might claim that is the European Union, but the European Union, unfortunately, does not have the power to make its presence or its interests prominent. Hence, it's been totally ignored in the Middle East for 25 years. Totally ignored, totally unimportant in Middle East politics. That's the problem for the Europeans. They're global, but they don't have the power to turn that into influence. What is this social imaginary? Social imaginary is an inclusive imaginary. There is still a kind of idea of westernization, that societies can be westernized, that societies can actually become part of the West. We're not just talking about Eastern Europe. That was westernized after 1989 and brought into NATO and brought into the European Union. The great prize was Russia. Just at the end of his life, Richard Nixon wrote an article for the New York Times, Who Lost Russia? Now, you should be familiar with that idea in China because the big debate in the United States after 1949 was who lost China? And the idea that that non-Western societies are there to be seized and brought into the Western community of states is a very, very strong idea. It's very strong. Now, just to remind you that this relationship between China and the United States goes back a long, long way to American missionaries at the end of the 19th century, and of course trading. Trading companies, because of course, in terms of capitalism, China was always seen as the biggest market in the world. If you could win the Chinese market, you really were going to make yourself extremely profitable and powerful. The Rockefeller Foundation in the 1930s produced a report in China saying it was democratic, plastic in its democratic possibilities. This was another great hope for Americans to democratize China, because if you've got the biggest country in the world as a democracy, then democracy is safe, is it not, for the future. That's the social imaginary of the United States. It's to win countries over, sometimes to incorporate them actually into the West, and sometimes to make sure that they're permanent partners of the West. That ambition hasn't gone. And the who lost Russia debate is extremely important because we actually thought we could westernize Russia, that we could bring Russia into these security architectures that we've created for ourselves. And since Putin, of course, the answer is no. There's an interesting article by Tom Friedman. I don't know whether any of you read the Herald Tribune and read his columns. Friedman is an interesting writer. He had this to say about Russia. The problem with Russia, he said, it's a sort of but not really country. It's a sort of democracy but not really. It's a sort of country that has the rule of law but not really. It's a sort of country that claims to be European, but it's not really European. It claims to have a free press, but not really. It claims that the Cold War is over, but actually not really. It claims that it's not just a petro-state, that it can modernize and become a modern 21st century economy, but not really. Nobody actually believes that's possible. Now, that is very much the language of the Western social imaginary. It's very dismissive. It's very dismissive of Putin. It's dismissive of the idea that there can actually be a non-Western Russia. It's the idea that modernization actually means westernization in the Russian case. And it's that degree of patronizing tone that irritates Russians, as it might irritate anyone else if it was applied to their country. So that's the first thing that one has to understand. The Western social imaginary is still strong. We still ask questions, who lost various societies? And that's not going to go away, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. Second problem is liberal internationalism, not liberalism. There are a set of liberal societies in the world. Most of them tend to be Western. Most of them tend to be members of organizations such as the European Union and NATO. But with being a liberal society comes an ideology, which is called liberal internationalism. When did this ideology actually start? Well, you can date it. We all play these games dating historical turning points. But for me, the interesting one was actually 1856. There was a debate in the British House of Commons about a war, which you're very familiar with because you call it the Second Opium War in China. But we call it the Arrow War. We used to call it the Arrow War. And it was a debate about the legitimacy of this war. And the country that had taken Britain to war in 1856, the government, was a liberal government in power. And it was the Conservative Party in opposition that filed a motion of no confidence in the government, hoping that it would win and the government would fall, on the grounds that Britain had gone to war for a set of ideas. It had not gone to war for its national interest, and that it was illegitimate to sacrifice the life of a British soldier for anything other than the national interest. Now, what was this set of ideas? The set of ideas was that if you went to war with China in 1856, you would open up the Chinese market to British goods, to free trade. And if you imposed free trade on China, you would open up Chinese minds to liberal ideas, to freedom. In other words, to use the language of today, but not the language of the 1850s, open society, open markets, and open minds are all part of a package of making a society liberal. And that war is one way by which you do this. It's not all that surprising because the other country to buy into liberal internationalism a little later was the United States. And I always irritate Americans, but I don't know why, because I don't think it's a ridiculous proposition when I say that the first nation-building exercise in history was the American Civil War. Because essentially what Lincoln was doing was going to war in 1860, not going to war in order to do this, but realizing after 1863 that he could, to change the regime in the South. Now remember, the Confederacy was a democracy, but it was not a liberal democracy, because it practiced slavery, which by the 1860s was inconsistent with every principle of liberalism. Remember also that there was a military occupation of the South for 19 years by the Union Army. Remember there was regime change and nation building. It was called Reconstruction, and the replacement of a plantation economy that was relied on slavery with a capitalist economy that relied on an ordinary workforce. So here was American nation building long before Afghanistan and Iraq, or Germany in 1945, or Japan in 1945. Here was the United States practicing nation building in America itself. If you think of it in those terms, you'll see why this is so strongly entrenched in the American national psyche. And as for my own country, well, here's a speech by Tony Blair. He said that it is Britain's destiny to change and shape the world in the image of liberal values. and that if Britain went out of that project, it would cease to be British. Now, Tony Blair fought 5 wars during his 10 years. Britain has actually fought 30 wars in the last 75 years. That's more than the United States. That shows the commitment of my country to liberal internationalism, using force if necessary, because we always hope we can do it through trade. But if that doesn't work, there's always force. So, you know, if you're asking people to go in for dialogues, it's asking a lot of the West, because you're asking us to change the way that we do things. What about the Europeans? Well, the Europeans have their own problem. It's called cosmopolitanism. And any of you who've been in a, I don't know how many of you have done EU courses, Brendan's done his EU courses, you know all about cosmopolitanism. The Kantian project, because it's associated with the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, it is the foreign policy of the European Union, cosmopolitanism. And it's based on the idea of syndicating European values across the world, changing international institutions, introducing concepts like human security, basically applying European rules to the regulation of the world. Not with force, unlike the United States or perhaps the UK, because the European Union doesn't have an army, but through law, through international law, to change that. And there's been some success, obviously, with environmental law since the Rio Conference in 1992, which has introduced a number of interesting liberal principles. You'll find this embodied, by the way, in a dialogue between China and the European Union. It's called the Cotonou Dialogue. It was opened up in 2008. It's about trade with Africa. It's a triangular dialogue, Africa, China, and the European Union. And the idea is to sell to China the idea that corruption is bad, supporting dictatorships is bad, the rule of law is absolutely essential for long-term investments. Not for short-term speculations or short-term gains, but for long-term investment. And if you're going to open up Africa, particularly Africa's resources, you need long-term investment. This is the kind of dialogue that the European Union believes in, which is, this is what we do, you should do the same. It's not really a dialogue, I think, as one might understand it. But that's actually EU policy. So this isn't just an academic exercise, and this isn't just an academic talk. The European Union is actually working to this very end, which is why it's unpopular. It's seen as a form of regulatory imperialism. Not cultural imperialism, not the old-fashioned political imperialism, but regulatory imperialism, changing the regulations of the game as the Europeans believe it should be played. There have been a few problems. And one of the problems, of course, is that the European model relies on a partnership between the state and NGOs. And that's fine, because there are 75,000 NGOs registered with the United Nations at the moment. The European Union, as you probably know, disperses nearly all its foreign aid through NGOs, not through the states, not through the European Commission, but through NGOs, nearly all of its foreign aid. But what happens when NGOs aren't liberal? A lot of those 75,000 NGOs are Western. They subscribe to Western liberal values, for example, on family planning. But there are Muslim NGOs that actually are against family planning, if it means contraception, abortion, or whatever. And they are now beginning to make their voice increasingly heard in the corridors of the international system, the United Nations. So the West, for the first time, is living with the terrible prospect of non-liberal NGOs. And this model is no longer quite as popular as it used to be. That's a problem for the European Union. So how do we get out of this? I think we fall back on a third idea, which is called communitarianism, which is quite popular amongst social scientists in the West at the moment, communitarianism, which is based on the principle that people derive their value as human beings and their esteem, because self-esteem is absolutely essential, from membership of a community. And that community is usually a nation state. It's not always a nation state, but it is for the moment, a nation state. And as you know, in Asia, the nation state has certainly got a future, even if it may not have one in Europe. That they may believe in world community, indeed they should believe in world community in an age of globalization, but they don't really buy into the concept of world citizenship. Citizenship is still associated with the nation state. They believe that life is social, of course. Our morality is based on pro-social values, the values of cooperation. That's why we have morality, that's why it's hardwired into us by natural selection, so that we can actually cooperate with each other. But that morality is cultural, or that society is cultural, and that people define their belief systems from the cultures. Now, that, I think, is probably where you would find Asia, a communitarian ideology. And what about the European Union? Well, what's happening in the European Union is that as the Eurozone struggles to survive, as the European governments try to integrate even more in, I think, a hopeless attempt to shore up this project, communitarianism is breaking out. Nationalism is on the rise in Europe. So is populism. So is fascism. There are two governments in Europe who should be suspended from membership of the European Union because they've abandoned practically democracy. One is Latvia and the other is Hungary. And they would have been suspended before the financial crisis in 2008. But we're not interested in this any longer. We're only interested in saving the euro and ensuring that we don't have financial collapse. But why are these governments so undemocratic? Because of populism, because of nationalism. In the case of Hungary, ethnicity as well. They're reviving their claims over the Hungarian minority in Romania. So what you have is a reassertion of nationalism, which is actually as a reflection of communitarianism, not in a very positive, unfortunately, sense, but perhaps in a negative sense. There was a famous German nationalist politician, Franz Josef Strauss. If you go to Munich Airport, you'll see it's named after Franz Josef Strauss, who famously said in 1957, anyone who wants to be German in the second half of the 20th century must first become a European. And that has been German foreign policy since 1949. That you can only be proud and you can only be a German nationalist in the context, really, of Europe. Because you must be both a German and a European. How many politicians today in Germany would be able to get up and say, if you want to be proud to be German, you must first be a European? I don't think any politician with aspiring ambitions would be saying this at the moment in Germany. Not if it means propping up Italy, Greece, and everything else that goes with it. I think we will see the rise of communitarianism in the United States as well. What's happening when we see a dysfunctional political landscape is essentially a battle within a governing class, a political class in the United States, which is already being sidelined by history, by demographics, by the fact that America is changing, that America in 25 years will be a very different society from the United States that we're familiar with, the United States that has managed the international system since the late 1940s. It will be partly Spanish-speaking. It will be communitarian in its Catholic values. It will be communitarian in its understanding of family life. It will be communitarianism in the idea that actually being bilingual is not necessarily a bad thing. It seems to work in other societies. Why shouldn't it work in the United States as well? It will be communitarianism because it will have very little interest in the future of Europe, because it will have very little affinity with European culture. It'll be much more interested in the future of Latin America, and it'll be much more interested in the future of Asia, because America is also becoming fast and furiously an Asian society and ceasing to be an Atlantic European society. And if you look at the trends, demographic trends, in the United States and look at American culture, I think you'll see this fascinating example of a society that is reinventing itself, which is America's great good fortune, which the Europeans do not have. of being able to reinvent itself, of being able to be something different from what it is now. And politicians like Obama and Romney will be antediluvian in 20 years' time. It's not even sure that the Republican Party itself can survive this demographic change, unless it changes very significantly. And then you will have, I think, societies on the that are in the West but not of the West, that want to be in the West but don't want to be of the West. And the one I'm thinking of here is clearly Turkey, a country that knows it will never join the European Union because of the French and German veto, which I suspect, because the Turks are extremely proud, will rescind its application to join the European Union within the next 5 to 10 years. It'll say, we don't want to join any longer. What would we be joining? What is this club? What have you got to show for yourself? It's pretty miserable at the moment. So that's not a disaster. Turkey will remain part of the European landscape. It will remain part of the European security architecture. It will remain inside the Western world as we understand it, but it will not be European as the EU would understand it. So there we are. I think that is the best that we can hope for. But I just want to end by saying what a dialogue isn't. And here I'm citing a famous Nobel Prize winning economist. Many of you will have studied economics, those alums at the LSE, Daniel Kahneman, who says the point about all dialogues is they're not about consensus. They're not about agreement. They're about agreeing to disagree. They're not about replacing one set of values with another, or one manager with another. They're a conversation. What the great LSE academic from the 1950s and 60s, Michael Oakeshott, called international relations a conversation of mankind. And what conversations do, if you engage in them long enough, is they produce habits of cooperation. Habits of cooperation. That's the best that you can aim for, and it's a lot to aim for. And Kahneman puts it rather nicely using a metaphor. He says that the problem with the United States and with some Western countries is that they enter minefields without knowing they've entered a minefield, like Iraq in 2003. It's perfectly obvious to everybody else that the West has entered a minefield, but the West can't see it. People who are looking in from the outside are much better at seeing the folly of your own actions than you are yourself. So that's the point about a conversation. So we prevent each other from entering minefields and blowing ourselves up. And I think on that rather limited note, but I hope it's a little bit of optimism in there if you search for it, we can open the session up. Thank you. So I see that there are Westerners in this audience, and probably Americans who will profoundly disagree with what I've said. There may be, are there any Europeans who will profoundly dislike what I've said about the European Union? And there may be Chinese who profoundly dislike what I've said, insofar as I've said anything about China. But let's open it up, and I don't know how much time we have. Really. Anybody who wants to come back? Yeah. Well, no, Britain doesn't have a dog in the fight, as we would say, to use an American expression. And it certainly can't really aspire to be an Asian power in that sense any longer. On the other hand, of course, it is never going to disagree with what the United States does. And it, in that sense, since the Americans will be backing the Japanese, it will be also backing the Japanese. It's Obama called us once again the closest ally in his speech at the Democratic Convention when he was criticizing Romney for his remarks about the London Olympics being badly managed. That was before they started, and he said closest ally. So David Cameron must have been very happy when he heard the news the next morning, because that's the phrase that the English cling on to for dear life. Henry Kissinger once said at Chatham House in 1982 when he came to give a speech on the special relationship, which is what people think Britain and the United States have, or what the British think they have with the United States. Was it a special? Yes, he said it was special, because I knew that every day a British Prime Minister wakes up in the morning and goes into the bathroom to clean his teeth. The first question he asks himself is, how can I be useful to the United States today? And we have no other allies in the world who ask themselves that question. We have to ask them to be useful. They don't try to be there first and be useful. So I'm afraid if you are hoping for some British mediation or moderation, you must completely dismiss this out of your mind. Now, I understand there are going to be 25 centres of British studies opening in China in the next few years, I was told by a Chinese professor. So you're still studying Britain for some reason, I'm not quite sure why. But that's good news for me, I suppose. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
That's a very complex question. Well, I don't think China takes the EU terribly seriously, so although there are the EU legations, etc., China takes bilateral relations with countries very seriously, and the European country that is most important to China, far above everyone else, is Germany, because of the extent of its trade and its cooperation. So that's the first thing. I wouldn't look too much at an EU policy towards these things. I would be much more interested in what a German policy in the future will be on these matters. And, of course, there's always the United States to take into account. But this, of course, assumes that military competition between these two powers is going to be old-fashioned, and it's going to be centered on conventional armaments. It's not going to be centered on conventional armaments. If there is a military conflict, we expect it to take place either in cyberspace or outer space. We don't expect some naval battle in the middle of the Pacific, a la World War II. It's just not going to happen. That cyberspace and outer space are areas where you don't need European cooperation, to be frank. And you don't need European weapon systems. But we will be very happy to sell them to you. So don't worry about that. And of course, all militaries are very old-fashioned. So obviously the Chinese Navy wants its aircraft carriers. You know, aircraft carriers are obsolete now. They're what battleships were in 1900. Obsolete. But nobody would say that in 1900 because the admirals loved their battleships. So Japan was building the biggest battleship in the world called the Yamato in 1937, which was sunk within 30 minutes of making its first and last voyage. I know this because I often work at the National Institute of Defense Studies in Tokyo. It's one of the few buildings that survived the bombing in 44-45, particularly the 44 bomb, March 45 bombing. And they've still got the, you know, when you're designing ships, you have these water tank things with the models in, still got the model of the battleship Yamato. Still there, you can see it. If you're lucky, you need permission to see it. So I'm obviously trusted enough to get that permission. So yes, I'm afraid people like their expensive weapon systems. There's a very good American writer, William Pfaff, who used to write for the Herald Tribune, I think he's retired now, who wrote a book on American exceptionalism. And he said that the U.S. Navy the aircraft carriers are always over the horizon, out of sight, and sailing out of history, looking for the Imperial Japanese Navy and never finding it. because of course the aircraft carriers would be marvellous at sinking the Imperial Japanese Navy, I mean the old Imperial Japanese Navy today, but they're not much good anywhere else. But that won't stop you from building aircraft carriers, because the admirals will want them. It's like manned aircraft. Are you from the forces or had any association with the military? No. No, I wondered why you asked the question. Yeah?
Hello, I'm someone from British Council, which is related to my question. I'm wondering what your take is on the kind of the role of soft power in international relations, because we've talked about military, economic, and other power structures, but China recently has significantly increased its engagement in soft power and with the growing influence of organisations like the Han Bao, the Confucius Institutes. Mm. But also these people-to-people dialogues that it's developed between the US, with Russia, with the EU, and last year began with the UK. So the UK was the chosen European partner for people-to-people dialogue. Now the State Council having that discussion. I was wondering what your take on that is in terms of China's positioning in global.
Well, yes, I think China's going to produce another 200 Confucius Institutes, something along that, or 300, I forget what the figure is. Yes, and everyone's doing this, the Germans are doing this like mad with their, what do they call their, the Goethe Institute. But the problem with soft power is that you can't disentangle it from hard power. And this was the Clinton line, the Hillary Clinton line, about smart power, which is soft and hard power being used together and not seeing them as distinctive, not an either or, but you have to see them as being associated. So we talk about smart power much more than soft power. Even Joseph Nye now, who's associated with inventing this concept, now talks about smart power. Smart power is important, but the European Union doesn't have it. Back in 2003, the EU issued its first strategy paper when Solana was the EU foreign policy man, essentially. And it said that in an age of terrorism, and we were all speaking this language after 9/11, you need a hard element to your soft power. And if you don't have that, then soft power is not going to enable you to achieve very much. And the European Union, of course, is in the process of the greatest degree of demilitarization in its history. Europe is literally vanishing from the map as a military power. And you come from a country now that has 17 ships in the Navy, 17, been overtaken by the French Navy for the first time since 1690. 17 ships of which only 8 or 9 can be at sea at any one time. And that what used to be one of the world's great navies. At one point was the world's greatest navy. That's the extent of demilitarization that's happening in the United Kingdom. And under David Cameron's defense cuts, the coalition's defense cuts, practically everything will be going in 10 to 15 years' time. So any of you who don't like Blair's wars and don't want Britain to be a liberal internationalist power, the good news is that we won't be a liberal internationalist power in 15 years' time, because we simply won't be able to do what we want to do or what Blair was able to do. Now, I'm sorry to emphasize the military side of that, because that's my particular speciality. It's what I feel most comfortable talking about. There are other elements of hard power. There's hard economic power and how that translates into sanctions, and whether the sanctions are smart sanctions now, of course, extremely important, so you're targeting people. Smart sanctions sometimes work, but smart sanctions sometimes require military action as well. And the obvious case that I always cite is Milosevic in Kosovo in 1999, when he blinked, but didn't need to, because he hadn't been defeated militarily. 79 days of an air campaign had failed to make any impression on his armed forces in Kosovo. So there are two explanations for why he gave up and agreed to leave Kosovo. One is that Russia said enough's enough. Remember, this was Yeltsin was still in power. He still wanted the close relationship with the West. He didn't want Milosevic to put it at risk. He wasn't interested in pan-Slavism. He wasn't interested in Russia as a Balkan power. He wanted Russia to be a partner of the West. That was still the pre-Putin line. But the real problem, the real clue, was given by Jamie Shea, who was the spokesman for NATO. He used to come out on television every night. When he was asked 10 days to the very end, why are we bombing casinos and hotels now? And he said, because we're a capitalist alliance. We understand the importance of private property. We are now bombing private property in Serbia, the private property of the mafia groups close to Milosevic, what we would call the clientele network that was sustaining him in power. We also, at the same time, embargoed their bank accounts. We had EU sanctions which prevented them from leaving the country and visiting their assets overseas. So we were using a mixture of smart sanctions and a degree of military power in taking out hotels and casinos, which was their property. And they had no interest in Greater Serbia, no interest in the historical injustices of losing Kosovo. They had an interest in keeping Milosevic in power because they made a lot of money out of him, and they were now losing it. They were the ones, I think, who told him it was time to call it a day. So I don't want to be overly cynical. You probably decided I'd been completely cynical, but it's just age and sclerosis of the arteries. Sorry about that. Everyone will suffer that at some point in this room at some time. But it is, I think, an interesting insight into soft and hard, yes, and that you can certainly reduce the necessity of military force then, definitely. It doesn't become a last resort, it becomes an option. But you can't disentangle the two. Yes. Well, I don't know whether the British Council has a view on that. It's a view that was first put forward in the 18th century during the European Enlightenment by the French philosophe, who definitely saw Europe as the apex of a triangle and that everybody could become European eventually. And it was a view propounded most famously by Napoleon when he took his soldiers to Egypt, showed them the pyramids, and said, "We're introducing the Egyptians to civilization," by which he meant European civilization. He didn't say that they hadn't got a civilization of their own, but he said that it hadn't made any progress in the last few centuries, and that they would be pulled by French soldiers into the future. My favorite story about Napoleon, and by the way, he brought with him 200 savants, 200 wise men, 200 intellectuals to map Egypt intellectually. He was the first conqueror to do that. I suppose Alexander the Great might have done that a little earlier, because he wanted knowledge being power, the knowledge of Egyptian culture. These 200 savants, these 200 professors, were extremely valuable to him, as were the mules, the donkeys, that were the logistic chain. So whenever the Egyptian army attacked him, the order would go donkeys and the professors to the rear. So that's how the professors were thought of in those days, a bit like donkeys in essence, but still valuable, very valuable. I don't think we think that any longer. I don't think we think European civilization is the apex of civilization. I think we see civilization as a process, we might call a work in progress that continues. Your question is there a universal civilization? And the answer is probably there is, in the sense that when you go around the world now, everything looks increasingly the same. However, that is merely a very facile impression based on how people dress and how often they travel. When you actually live in a country, you will realize that the cultural differences are amplified by globalization. There is a much greater cultural diversity than there's ever been in human history. And it is actually powered by social networks, it's powered by technology. People celebrate difference, they want to. If you're very postmodern, and I don't know whether postmodernism has hit China in any big way, you talk about the carnival. Politics is a carnival. People can dress up like the Notting Hill Carnival in London. They can wear whatever they want to be. They can be whatever they want to be. This is the great privilege of living in the early 21st century. That's the idea. But that's where I would get to. There is the reason why there's this diversity is that I think we have the same value system. That this cultural dialogue project at the Chatham House is based on a thesis. And the thesis is that it is not values that divide people, it is norms that divide people. Because actually, it would be very difficult for you to point to anyone who has different values from me as a European. In fact, we've had the same value system roughly for, I would say, about 1400 years, going back to the great period in human history called the Axial Age, between 700 BC, as we would say, and 300 BC, going back to Confucius, Socrates, the Buddha, going back to Zoroastrianism, from which, of course, Islam, Christianity emerged, and the Hebrew prophets, all living in this 400-year period of history, no contact with each other whatsoever, all producing a value system that we associate with either the philosophies that emerged or the religious monotheistic or non-monotheistic religious systems that emerged. Fascinating. The only part of the world that didn't have the Axial Age was the Americas, because they were cut off, literally. This is why human sacrifice survived right up into the 15th century. This was an abomination for all the major philosophies and monotheistic faiths from Europe to Asia. But norms, that is how you institutionalize your values, how you live those values, how you celebrate those values, they change a lot. So remember what won George Bush the election in 2004, the three G's, gays, God, and guns. And the Europeans, they don't do God, they don't do guns, and they do gays. And this was norms. And people said, oh, look, Americans have different values from Europe. That's what they said to explain why George Bush was re-elected. Of course, America doesn't have different values from Europe. They're exactly the same. And not because they're Western, but because the values every civilization shares. But the norms are very, very different. And I'll just give you a very quick example of that, if I may. If you go to York, a city up in the north of England, you go to York Minster, which is one of the great cathedrals of the medieval period. You know how it was celebrated in the 12th century when it opened its doors for the first time to the public? They burnt Jews outside the gates, because if you were a good Christian, that's how you celebrated Christianity. You know, enemies of Christ, the killers of Christ, etc. In the 16th century, there were no Jews to burn, because they'd all been expelled from England 200 years earlier. They were burning old women, who they called witches. In the mid-17th century, they burnt a cat, because it caught a mouse on Sunday, and thus broke the law of the Sabbath, that you shouldn't work on a Sunday. In 1988, when the cathedral caught fire, because it was hit by lightning, and a quarter of it was burned down, the Archbishop of York rushed onto television to tell the faithful, this was not an act of God, you know, this is just an accident. Well, unfortunately, it was an act of God in the insurance understanding, against which, unfortunately, you can't insure yourself, and therefore they would have to pay high premiums. But you can see, Christian values haven't changed in those 900 years. You know, the Ten Commandments are still there. They're still the essence of Christianity, as they're the essence of practically every religious system in the world, except you don't call them the Ten Commandments. But the point is, the understanding of what it means to be a Christian has changed enormously as we've moved from a pre-modern to a modern into a kind of post-modern world, as we've moved from pre-industrial into industrial world. This is the reality. And it's the norms that people find very, very difficult. Because if you are professing the same values as me, but you're living a different life from me, I find that very difficult to accept. If you're telling me that your values are totally different from mine, I can say we can coexist perfectly happily. You butt out of my world and I'll butt out of your world, okay? And what divides us is that civilizations are so similar, not so different. But the answer is not uniformity, as we would have thought 100 years ago. The answer is to live with difference and cultivate it in non-violent forms. So, I must entertain you too long. Yes? Well, the United Nations would need to be reformed. And that brings us to the first problem. who's going to lead the Security Council and who's going to join the Security Council. And as you know, China vetoes India joining the Security Council. And the Europeans don't want to lose their two seats. It's often said, why don't we have the EU, the European Union, as a permanent member of the Security Council? The French would find that unacceptable, as with the British. And the Germans would want their own seat, probably. Japan should be a member, should it not, of the Security Council? Who's preventing that? I'm not going to name names or identify countries. Brazil should be a member of the Security Council, but no one in the Organization of American States wants to be represented by Brazil. Argentina wants to be represented by Argentina. South Africa, in Africa? Well, no, because the Nigerians would say that's completely unacceptable. You know, there are two big powers in Africa, Nigeria and South Africa. And it's either both of us or neither of us. So where do you start? And then you have to reform the General Assembly as well. And I don't think the UN has done wonderful things under Ban Ki-moon. I don't think Ban Ki-moon has been one of the great Secretary Generals of all time. No. By the way, here's something you didn't know. I don't know whether you believe in UFOs or not. Have you ever seen a UFO? No. Well, most intelligent people haven't, and the fascinating thing about ufology is that most of the people who've been abducted by aliens have very low IQs. They're not famous. But there is one famous guy who was abducted by an alien. It's in his memoirs. Pérez de Cuellar, who was Secretary General of the United Nations, the first Latin American Secretary General, who claims he was walking in the Andes Mountains one day in his youth, and he was abducted by aliens. Now, I bet we didn't know that at the time that we appointed him Secretary General. This is a revelation in his memoirs. Unless, of course, you believe in alien abduction, in which case, fine, could well have happened. So that is going to be the real problem, the reform of the UN. You know, the former Singaporean ambassador said that, of course, the UN is a construction of the West, very large in 1942, obviously. Works like Wendell Willkie, the Republican candidate in 1940, One World. But let me say one very good thing about the United States, if I may here. America has always been on China's side in this, not communism's side, but China's side. Back in 1940, Roosevelt could have done a deal with the Japanese, which essentially was saying you have an open hand in China, a free hand for the foreseeable future, because he realized that Germany was the most important enemy that the United States had to face. He knew war was coming with Hitler, and he knew it was going to be Germany first. And you never want to fight a two-front war if you can avoid it. And there were people saying to him, very close advisors, give China up to Japan, and then you can fight Japan when it's convenient for us to fight Japan. Any excuse will do. It's not going to be difficult. And he said, we can't do that, because China is one of the great powers and must be represented in this new world order that we would like to see emerge. And that's why America insisted, against British and French objections, that China was one of the big five powers, that it should be represented at some of those conferences, not all the conferences. This was the importance. And that was American missionaries were giving sermons on Sundays, telling their parishioners, give money to China, to the relief funds, refugee relief funds, etc., famine relief funds. This was the conscience. America had that vision, but the United Nations should have China as a permanent member from the very, very beginning. It didn't happen because, of course, obviously, 1949, they weren't willing to have communist China in. So the US is not standing in the way of United Nations reform. The Europeans are more likely to be standing in the way of United Nations reform for their own personal reasons. But who's going to make the first move? Because nation states don't like negotiating away their power positions. It's instinctive to want your own seat, isn't it? And deny it to those countries you think are potentially competitors in the future. One more? Okay. Last question.
So we spoke about the West needing to engage in dialogue with the non-West.
Mm.
In terms of the non-West engaging in dialogue with the West, and for the purposes of right now, China engaging with the non-West, where do you see that right now? and how do you imagine that evolving with the change of government?
Which change of government? I wouldn't say change of government, I would say change of personnel, but yeah. It's a bit like the coalition government in Britain, yes. Change of personnel. Well, look, let me put it this way. What I think is very promising, this is the good news, and then I'll tell you the bad news. The good news is that what the US is trying to do is to hedge its bets. We all know about hedge funds that were invented in the 40s, but we only talked about them in the 70s and 80s. What you do in a hedge fund, as you know, is maximize the opportunities and minimize the risks. So what the US has tried to do with China is to minimize the risk of China's rise and maximize the opportunities that it provides or might provide. And it's done that by putting China in these international organizations that were American creations, by giving larger voting rights, and by fast-tracking membership of the WTO, for example, which is denied to Russia for 10 years. Russia only got in very, very recently because Russia wasn't important enough to fast-track economically. So that's good. That's a hedging strategy. Now, China also has a hedging strategy with the United States. You know, these conferences in some think tanks in China since 2006, how can we manage America's decline? How can we slow it down? Because the last thing China wanted, or the Chinese government wanted, was this sudden, rapid reduction in American power and influence in the world. It is not good for anyone, since, I say, America provides a service, and it does provide a service in many, many areas, and China would recognize that. Wouldn't say it publicly, but it tacitly recognizes at the moment it's the only country that is providing a service. It's the only really global player. So that's the good news. The bad news is associated with Chinese nationalism. If you lose control of that process, and no one has ever managed to control nationalism, I mean, Germany is the excellent example at the end of the 19th century, where the politicians like Bismarck thought they could control it and focus it, and realized it had got out of control. And if the military becomes an independent factor with its own agenda, then what you might have, and this is the real fear, is a return to the regional security system that existed in this part of the world for 700 years, and it was called the Sinosphere, which was a Chinese-managed regional security system, which was destroyed in 1840 in the First Opium War, and the Europeans came along and imposed two normative principles, which meant that you couldn't have a Sinosphere or any other kind of sphere. You could only have an international system. One of those normative principles was equality of sovereignty, that all nations were equal. We know, of course, that's not true, but we say that all nations are equal. That's why they're all in the United Nations. They all have a vote. And also contract law, international law, that all treaties must be contractual. They must be legally enforced, that international law keeps the system together. So you can't have a tribute system. You can't have a hierarchy with China at the apex and everyone down below. You can't have the idea of the Middle Kingdom being special, Chinese exceptionalism, if you want to put it that way, like American exceptionalism, which is very different. You can't have, and you had to have a secular, entirely secular system, so there are no religious principles behind the international order. This is what Al-Qaeda finds objectionable about the international order, that it's secular. That was not a problem with China, of course, the secular part. So if there should be a temptation to recreate the Sinosphere, and this is why people feel a little unhappy about what's happening in the South China Seas. In the midterm, we're not talking about tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but in the midterm, this would be very, very difficult for dialogue because it would be challenging the international order. Now, we don't know what China's ideas for the international order are because you don't know what your ideas for the international order are. You've got lots of think tanks out there producing all these ideas, but they're just at the moment on the margins of the debate. It's not what the leadership is interested in at the moment, interested in stability and economic growth and all of that. But what happens when you've got so much more power in 10 and 15 years and you've got many more ambitions for you and other people? That's what we don't know. Because the Americans will stick with the show that they've run so far because it's worked for them and it's still working for them. And the Europeans don't have any other alternative ideas to put forward. They kind of run out of ideas. And so it's going to be a very interesting future. And whether you're going to be optimistic or pessimistic depends a lot on domestic politics in China. And I'm not a sinologist, I'm not a China expert, I only read the Financial Times and the Economist when it comes to China. So that's all I